Today is Friday, September 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the U.S. seems more certain Iran is behind attacks on the Saudi oil facility, Tehran threatens war if there's retaliation.
I think you're going to see a significant operation. I think it's going to be a thoughtful operation, and I don't think it will be just the United States, or it may not be the United States at all.
A whistleblower complaint reportedly about a Trump promise to a foreign leader is sparking a firestorm in Washington. Also ahead, millions around the world plan to walk out of school and work today in demand of climate action. It's all on today's International Edition. Tehran's top diplomat warned Thursday that an attack on Iran by the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will spark an all-out war, raising the stakes as Washington and Riyadh weigh a response to a drone and missile strike on the kingdom's oil industry that shook global energy markets. The comments by Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif represented the starkest warning yet by Iran in a long summer of mysterious attacks and incidents, more than a year after President Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. Pentagon spokesman Jonathan Hoffman says the U.S. has a high level of confidence the Saudis will be able to accurately determine who launched the attacks.
Indications are that this is in some way the Iranians are responsible for this. But we are going to allow the Saudis to make their own conclusion and to present that to the public and the international community.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in the Middle East meeting with the leaders of several allies in the Middle East, where he described an enormous consensus in the region that Iran was behind the attack. Joining us to discuss all of it is Dr. Bill Parker, president and CEO of the East-West Institute. Thank you for being with us. Dr. Parker, do you agree with this consensus?
As we look at this more and more, it is certainly leaning in that direction, especially as you're hearing both Republicans and Democrats, to include Pompeo and then Panetta, both just came out with statements on this. And you're hearing a very defensive Iran right now, making very strong statements of it will be an act of war if you do anything against us, et cetera, which means they're getting concerned as well. Hmm. So it's looking more and more like there may be some real truth to this. I am feeling very good, though, that the world is not reacting instantaneously, but instead looking at all of the facts and really researching this before any action is taken. I think it's really good to see that the world is taking a deep breath and is looking at this before jumping into any kind of combat operations.
Well, there were concerns initially when the president was tweeting the U.S. is locked and loaded, and I think a lot of people were a little anxious that we were jumping into a war before all the facts were in. I'm pretty sure they probably already know who's responsible. Is that safe to say?
I think that is safe to say. I think that not only the U.S. intelligence, but the intelligence in the region there is good enough that they probably have a very good feel of which ones of those missiles, drones, et cetera, came from Iran, where they originated from. And I'm sure they have enough parts that they've already done forensic analysis on to assess who built those systems as well.
You would think Iran would know that it would be easy to determine that they did it. And now this was an attack on Saudi Arabia. Is this the responsibility of the U.S. to retaliate, or what are the options for the U.S.?
The United States has several options. One, they can stay out of it altogether. Two, they can help Saudi Arabia in their response. Three, they can build their own coalition within the Middle East and say, look, we're not going to put up with this in Saudi Arabia or anywhere else. Or they can look at very heavy sanctions or other actions that are beyond those of military operations. But I think, as you saw Panetta say today, I think that you're going to see a military response of some sort, whether it's from the United States, Saudi Arabia, or somewhere else, because something is necessary when you take 50% of the oil production capability on their sovereign territory.
What are the potentials for escalation beyond some sort of tactical strike against specific targets?
I think that's the question that probably a lot of people are looking at right now. I'm sure they're giving lots of options to both the president and to other countries around the globe right now of what are not only our responsibilities, but what possibilities do we have here. We can do nothing on one side. We can do sanctions only, or we can do military operations. If we're going to do military operations, you would think that at this point, if in fact we can prove, or someone can prove without a shadow of a doubt, that it came from Iran, then I think you're going to see some kind of significant combat operation beyond just a pinprick, just beyond just a couple tomahawk strikes, beyond just one or two targets. I think you're going to see something more significant. And I say that because you have to look back at the history. After the fall of the Shah, you know, you had 52 diplomats that were held from 79 to 81. You had 241 American, mostly Marines, that were killed in the suicide bombing in Lebanon. You had the mine attack in 1988, truck bombing attack that wounded 372 and killed 20 in 1996 in Saudi Arabia. Then you had the support of the 9/11 hijackers, and that list goes on and on. So this is not a one-time thing, but actually an escalation from Iran that you're seeing over a very long period of time. And at some point, you say enough's enough. Now, I don't know if that's today. Action is going to be taken, I think.
If there's an action taken and Iran's declaring that would mean war, I would imagine that that could lead to potentially very difficult times for the Middle East and the U.S.
I think that's right. I think that Iran should not be taken lightly. They have a significant military, but that Iran would be making a significant emotional mistake if, in fact, they thought that they were going to go to war with the United States or our major allies, and they were going to win that. I think they would be leveled as a country if they did that, and I don't think anybody wants that. I also don't think that the United States or, quite frankly, any other countries want to be dragged into another war in the Middle East. So that's probably the difficult decision that's made right now is how heavy do you go in?
Right.
At a time when you have an administration that has made the statements and you could offer, when you really look at it, has made a lot of effort to get out of combat operations as opposed to get into them. So while there's a lot of chest pounding, you're not seeing a lot of operations on the ground. And I think you'll continue to see an effort to get out of Afghanistan as well as we move forward on that one.
So should Americans just sort of hold their breaths and wait?
I think what you're going to see is a significant operation. I think it's going to be a thoughtful operation. And I don't think it will be just the United States, or it may not be the United States at all. I think that there are serious people that are having serious discussions around the globe right now. And again, I go back to my initial statement that I think it's good news that you didn't see any kind of instantaneous response here, but instead people are looking into the intelligence and looking into all the options before they move forward.
All right. Dr. Bill Parker is president and CEO of the East West Institute. Thanks for being with us. The government's intelligence watchdog will testify about the handling of a whistleblower complaint, AP correspondent Mike Hempen reports.
The Washington Post reports Inspector General Michael Atkinson is to testify today. According to the Post, the complaint involves an intelligence official's allegation that President Trump made an unspecified promise to a foreign leader. The Post cites two anonymous former U.S. officials. However, the Associated Press has not confirmed the report. The Intelligence Committee Chairman, Congressman Adam Schiff, says Atkinson determined the whistleblower complaint was credible and urgent. Mike Hempen, Washington.
The United States Thursday accused Afghanistan's government of failing to fight corruption and cut more than $160 million in direct funding a little over a week before the Afghanistan election. Joining us on VOA Asia is Michael Kugelman, the Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Michael, why do this now?
Well, I think the Trump administration wanted to deliver a very strong message to the Afghan government very soon before the election, in which it essentially emphasizes that issues like governance and transparency and accountability are important to the Trump administration, and that it's not going to write blank checks to whatever government may be in power in Afghanistan. And in that regard, I think it's actually a very good decision. And in fact, I wish that the U.S. had done things like this in previous years, because we know there's so many cases of the U.S. pouring huge amounts of money into projects that go nowhere because of corruption within the Afghan political system. So I guess I would say in this case, better late than never to be making this move now.
Well, we all know that President Trump, after a Taliban attack, there was one earlier today or yesterday, and almost every day there's another Taliban attack in Afghanistan, has ended the talks with the Taliban, talks that did not include the Afghanistan government. So how does this all fit in with the talks or lack of talks and the whole scenario?
Well, you know, unfortunately, even when the talks were still going on, both sides, the U.S. side and the Taliban side, were escalating violence, really in order to strengthen their bargaining position in talks. And now that the talks are off indefinitely, you're having even more escalation. And the U.S. government has been very upfront about this. I mean, very soon after Trump called off talks, you had senior officials, including Trump himself, say very clearly that we're going to step up the fight on the battlefield. And I think for the U.S., the idea is to put enough pressure on the Taliban that it would be willing to come back to the negotiating table and be willing to make concessions in negotiations that it was not willing to make when the U.S. and the Taliban were negotiating earlier. And I think in particular, what the U.S. government wants or would want would be a concession from the Taliban to agree to a ceasefire. It would be hard to pull off, for sure. And on the Taliban side, I think that the idea there is to continue doing what it's been doing for really the last year at least, and that's to try to terrorize the country, strengthen its bargaining position, and make the U.S. and the Afghan government, for that matter, feel desperate enough and scared enough that they would be perfectly happy to sign whatever deal they could get with the Taliban.
Is fright, is terror the way to go? Is that a logical conclusion, or is that the way the Taliban thinks?
Well, the Taliban, unfortunately, is very clever. And the Taliban, it knows that it is in no rush to get a deal, unlike the United States. So it's perfectly happy to scale up violence to try to make the U.S. feel desperate and, you know, come into negotiations at whatever time and be willing to essentially go along with whatever the Taliban wants it to go along with. Because at the end of the day, the Taliban wants to negotiate with U.S. government. It wants a deal for a troop withdrawal. That is all that it has made clear that it wants. It wants to get U.S. troops out of the country. So that's why the Taliban will do whatever it can to try to bring the U.S. to the table and be willing to go into negotiations on the Taliban's terms. And that's what's happened to this point. The Taliban hasn't wanted the Afghan government involved in talks. They haven't been involved. The Taliban has not really wanted to commit to anything other than agreeing to sever ties with international terrorists, and that's what would have been in this deal that was canceled. So bottom line is things have gone just according to the Taliban's plan.
Michael Kugelman is Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Thanks, Michael.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump gets a victory in a bid to block California from seeing his tax return. The company gunmaker Colt will stop producing AR-15 rifles for civilians. Afghan children will make up half of the world's poor by 2030. And the Washington Monument reopened to the public Thursday after years of closure to replace its aging elevator and security system. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Will the consequences of climate change become ever more clear and dire, a powerful wave of climate movement have been swelling over the past couple of years as young people around the world rise up to demand action and as world leaders arrive in New York for a United Nations Climate Summit on September 20th today. A day of striking by students and adults will take place as they walk out of school and work. Joining us to talk more about the massive youth-led movement is 16-year-old Naina Agarwal-Hardin. Naina, most people I introduce have one title, but you have so many that I will let you tell us.
A national organizer with Sunrise Movement. I'm co-deputy director for global outreach with Zero Hour. I'm a head organizer of my local climate strike, and I'm also on the national communications team for the organization called U.S. Youth Climate Strike.
I'm sure there's one main theme with all of the organizations that you are representing and working with. What is the main goal And why are you fighting so hard?
So each organization has its own specific goals. I think the biggest goal that has been like a continuous thing throughout all of my advocacy is the emphasis on climate justice and not just climate action, recognizing that those who have contributed the least to this crisis are and will continue to suffer the most.
That would be like maybe people in the Bahamas? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. So seeing developed nations like the United States turn away those climate refugees after their homes have been destroyed because of a crisis that we created, not them. That's really sobering, and that's something that all of us are fighting really hard for. That's a huge motivation. And then in terms of why we're fighting so hard, I think with the youth climate movement, at least, we're terrified of what the future might hold if we don't. The only way to cope.
Tell me a little bit about that anxiety.
Well, when you wake up and there's a new report of a different devastating natural disaster pretty much every morning, you get really scared for what the future might hold for you. And when you read the IPCC report saying that, you know, we have just under 11 years at this point to radically transform our entire planet's economy, you get really scared for what the future might hold for you, because some of us will be like 25 when that time frame is up. Some of us will be 30. Some of us will be even younger. Some of us might be 20. So, you know, it's like we won't have even lived by the time that a lot of this damage becomes irreversible. And you know, that's bound to cause anxiety.
So what kinds of things, obviously, I guess, like you mentioned, every organization may have a different angle or mission toward, obviously, the same goal, which deals with climate change, or at least in part some aspect of the ramifications of climate change. What specifically is happening Friday?
It's going to be historic day in which there's a mass mobilization to demand climate justice. And this is, for me at least, this is young people taking back their power and showing the world that we mean business and we're not going to give up on our futures.
I understand this is global. Seems like every time we hear about it, there are more events and more things planned. I would imagine this is going to involve millions and millions of people and not just youth.
There are over 1,000 strikes in the U.S. alone. It's over 150 countries that people are striking in. It's going to be massive. And what's really powerful about September 20th is that this is a general strike. Teachers are striking. Doctors are striking. A lot of Amazon employees are striking. Mm-hmm. Google employees, everyone is striking. And it gives me a lot of hope to see how intergenerational the movement has become. There's a lot of sharing of knowledge and wisdom that's happening. But for the most part, adults have been incredible about making sure that it remains youth-led and youth-driven.
When you say strike, do you mean not going to school, not going to work, or do you also mean that includes taking to the streets?
Both. Most people who plan to strike tomorrow plan to go to school, go to work, whatever it is, and walk out at some point during the day. But of course, it's going to vary based on the strike event. So some events are happening later at night, and some people, yeah, probably won't go to school or work at all, but it's just going to depend who and where they are.
What specifically are you planning on doing?
I will walk out of school at 11. I will rally at 12, and I'm going to be the last speaker at my local climate strike rally. Then we're going to have some workshops to teach people who come to our climate strike about how to get involved in the movement and get active. We're expecting between 5 and 10,000 participants. And after that, I am getting on a plane and flying to New York City for the Youth Climate Summit at the UN that's happening on Saturday.
A lot of change will probably have to come at the ballot box with people voting to change to leadership that is willing to take a strong stand on environmental protection. Is that part of a focus for a lot of students that will be coming of voting age?
Yes, absolutely. I know at our local strike, we are going to be getting people registered to vote. I have tons of friends in the youth climate movement who have similar plans at their local strikes, because the next step is to vote out these people that are not acting and give power to people who will fight for us.
I'm sure that on some level, this must at least provide some comfort given the fear and the concern about the future, just to see the mobilization that, you know, has really caught fire.
Definitely. There's so much solidarity. There's so much shared experience. Absolutely reassuring, and it definitely gives me hope.
All right, that's 16-year-old climate activist Naina Agarwal-Hardin, working with Sunrise Movement, Zero Hour, and many others. Thanks for being with us, and keep up the great work. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup, live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. In Africa, hundreds of indigenous languages are on the verge of extinction, according to the UN Culture Organization, UNESCO. That includes at least 13 languages in Kenya. This week, Kenyan civic society groups met in Nairobi to discuss a proposed bill that, if passed into law, would preserve and safeguard these disappearing dialects. Raoul Lambour reports.
Year old Leriman Letiko sits under a tree, passing down knowledge of a culture and a dialect that may be near its end. Letiko and his 95-year-old brother Leteyon are the only two left in a tribe of about 10,000 who can speak fluent Yakunte. UNESCO classifies the Yakunte language as extinct, but the Yaku, an indigenous tribe in the Mukogodo forest and its environs in Laikipia, a county in north-central Kenya, are fighting to keep it alive.
Kwa sababu nimekuta wa mama ya hawa, hawa ndugu yangu.
Both my mother and grandmother spoke Yakunte. The period when we started interacting more and intermarrying with the Maasai, that's when the language started to get lost. When we married into a different tribe, we adopted their languages. Most Yakus now speak Kimasai, the language of their Laikipia Maasai neighbors. Leriman Letiko has been using oral tradition to pass down the language and cultural knowledge to his son and other Yakus. He says the only way to save the Yakunte dialect is by introducing it in local schools.
Wakati kama huu, elimu amekusha ingia Kenya.
Right now, we have schools and we have education. If the language is introduced in schools in this area, get teachers and the older Yakus involved, I'm confident the language can be revived. Civil society groups and the Kenyan Ministry of Sports, Culture and the Arts have drafted a bill to document and promote indigenous languages in Kenya. Josfeta Mukobe is the principal secretary in the Ministry's State Department of Culture and Heritage.
My State Department is charged with languages. Yeah. So we are developing a policy to see whether we can preserve some of these languages. But as I said, a language is only important when it's used. Even when we develop that language and there's nobody to speak it, we never hear of it.
Kimani Njogu, a linguist who also is a member of the Academy of African Languages, says languages can die like anything else.
Because of globalization and urbanization, and also the fact that we do not seem to be having very systematic transfer of languages across generations. So you have older people not transferring their language to younger people, as well as systems of education where certain languages dominate the systems of education. So quite a number of languages are actually endangered.
Njogu adds that information technology should be used to capture these languages before they disappear. This is a goal that the Yaku Laikipia Trust, an organization mainly dealing with the advocacy issues around the Yaku, is championing. Jennifer Konate is the trust's director.
And what we want to embark on is documentation, taking the voice of the elders that are available, those that are fluent, bringing them together to continue talking. So we want to have a place where we shall be talking, they will be talking themselves, we'll be recording their language.
If that happens and the bill on language policy passes, Yakunte and other indigenous languages may live on, something that would make Leriman Letiko feel his efforts were not in vain. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Laikipia, Kenya.
Well, we're going to end the show today in honor of the millions of young people out there and adults fighting for the future in today's massive worldwide climate strikes in what's expected to be the largest mobilization for climate action in U.S. in human history. Young people and adults will be standing arm in arm, demanding action in a mutual fight for the future of humanity. We're on a planet that has a problem. We've got to solve it, get involved and do it now. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Make it last, make it fast, and do it now, now, now. We need to build a better future, and we need to start right now. No point in waiting or hesitating. We must get wise, take no more lies, and do it now, now, now. We need to build a better future.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million each for information leading to the identification or location of Farouk al-Suri, Sami al-Uraidi, and Abu Abed al-Karim al-Masri. The three men are senior leaders of the Tanzim Horas ad-Din, an al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist group that emerged in Syria in early 2018. The group is fighting in Syria. These three men have all been active in al-Qaeda for many years, and today they remain loyal to the group's leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Farouk al-Suri, who is also known as Samir Hijazi, and Abu Hamam al-Shami, is a Syrian. Al-Suri has been active in the al-Qaeda terrorist organization for decades. In the 1990s, he was a senior paramilitary trainer in Afghanistan and trained fighters for the group in Iraq from 2003 to 2005. From 2009 to 2013, al-Suri was detained in Lebanon and afterwards became the military commander of the al-Nusra Front. He left the al-Nusra Front in 2016. Abu Abed al-Karim al-Masri, also known as Karim, comes from Egypt. In 2018, al-Masri was a member of Tanzim Horas ad-Din's Shura, the group's senior decision-making body, and served as a mediator between Tanzim Horas ad-Din and the al-Nusra Front. The Jordan-born Sami al-Uraidi, also known as Abu Mahmoud al-Shami, is a senior Sharia leader of Horas ad-Din. In the past, he was involved in terrorist plots against the United States and Israel. Like Karim, al-Uraidi is also a member of Tanzim Horas ad-Din's Shura. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Diplomatic Security Service. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If anyone has such information, please contact the Rewards for Justice via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net, email info@rewardsforjustice.net, or contact the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.